The Anton Savage Show with Kearies.ie on News Talk.
Kieran Mullooly is with us, as is Louise Byrne, who is the political correspondent for The Mirror, and Brian Mann, political correspondent for the Irish Daily Mail. Brian, let me start with you. Reading between the lines, it doesn't sound like there is a warming of the frosty relationship between IALPA and Aer Lingus.
No, there wasn't a huge amount of wiggle room kind of given by Mark there. I mean, maybe that's the way it's done in terms of these kind of public statements and declarations that they'll continue to battle on and fight on. And he kind of cited the 66% kind of pay increase that executives get that he said they got. I think the problem for IALPA is pretty simple. I think most people who see a group of workers on over 200k a year asking for a 24% pay increase aren't going to have a huge amount of sympathy for them, and then they're going to inconvenience those people even further by ruining their holidays. They may well have a fair claim to make in the context of the job that they do, but I don't think most people really care about the broader context.
I suppose the one thing, Louise, in that they may say is that it doesn't really matter if they get political support. All that matters is, have they got leverage over their employer?
Probably, but I think public support is going to have to play into it as well, because, I mean, it comes back to Brian's point. When you see a group of people on huge amounts of money, and now it's worth saying they're not all on huge amounts of money, and IALPA would make the argument that, you know, the cadets, they start lower down the entry level. I think it's around 42,000 for a pilot. So
the claim is for everybody,
and I think, you know, the general public would go, well, perhaps if you gave the lower ranking people an increase of 24%, we'd be in favour of that. But when you look at the higher people, and, you know, you're speaking in some instances of people getting pay rises of 50,000 euro, I mean, that's people, some people don't even earn 50,000 euro. Like, 50,000 euro is considered quite a good wage, so I think that's where the issue is. Political support, there's very little for it, I think, at the moment. I think there's frustration from the government on both sides, and you heard the Taoiseach say that earlier in the week. The Taoiseach was saying it, I was in Brussels this week, he was saying it on Friday, that there is frustration, and he was giving out about this tit for tat on the airwaves, and he was saying that really people just need to get back into the room. But I think even with the issue of getting back into the room is how much willingness is there for compromise. It doesn't seem like there is. I know the Sunday Independent were reporting that Mark Tighe went in, and rather than a 24% increase, he said he was willing to bring it down to 21%, and that wasn't near good enough for Aer Lingus, who are saying, I think they're offering something like 12.25%. So I think there's a long way to go, and I think it's going to inconvenience an awful lot of people at a time where they're just gasping to get away after a tough couple of months.
Well, the Taoiseach will be with us in a while, and we will put to him what he thinks the solution might be. Tech saying, Mark says the solution lies with management, the solution lies with both parties. 24% is not reasonable and does not demonstrate negotiating in good faith. 53106 if you want to get in touch, or 087 1400 106. At the same time as Mark Tighe, as you heard, was reiterating his point about 66% pay increases for management, the most recent statement from Aer Lingus doubles down on some of their criticism of IALPA. It says, Aer Lingus apologises to passengers for the serious disruption caused by IALPA's strike action. The company restates its view that today's strike action by IALPA, this issued yesterday, is very damaging to our customers, the wider staff in Aer Lingus, and the company itself. IALPA's actions continue to inflict serious reputational and financial damage on the airline and are increasingly making a resolution of this dispute more difficult. The first part of that sentence, Kieran Mullooly, the actions are inflicting serious reputational and financial damage on the airline. That's kind of the point, isn't it?
It is. Firstly, Anton, welcome to my constituency. Welcome to Lockheed. Hope you're enjoying the fresh air out here. And by the way, I hope you go catch up with King House and Boyle and a few more of our features before you go back. The damage is huge. It's not about the economic damage to Aer Lingus and to the country are the key issues here. But to me, from the personal perspective, standing in Brussels airport on Wednesday night, looking at a screen which said Aer Lingus flight cancelled, is absolutely petrifying. Families preparing for the holidays, looking out today, wondering, having saved all year, this has to be dealt with quickly. I mean, I know Mark is coming out and he's putting his best foot forward, but there's a big difficulty for the pilots here. They've really got, and the captains, they've really got to come out front with regard to this wage increase issue they're after. You consider that the average pay, we're told the average pay of an airline pilot is 80,000 euro. The average additional pay in a year is about 25. That's 105,000 average pay. And when you come down to this part of the country and you hear that, you know, 57% of people in farming earned less than 20,000 euro last year, there's a huge void there. They're going to have to come forward very quickly and make their case in a more convincing style.
How do they close that gap, though? Because the delta between 12% and 24% is hugely significant, and there doesn't seem to be any chinks in either side's armour.
Listen, industrial relations happens like this all the time. We have a starting point, a middle point, and eventually this is going to be solved. At the end of the day, it's going to be solved. If I was in the captain's situation, I would be highlighting the lack of engagement by Aer Lingus up to this point. How do we get to this situation? That's the key issue for me. Is there a failure by Aer Lingus management to deal with this issue before it came to the point where we've left the country out on the side of in the middle of the summer season? It's absolutely crazy what's going on. And I think there's going to be further implications that as we go into next weekend and the following weekend. You know what's going to happen. There's going to be considerable more pressure on Aer Lingus and the unions to solve this. It's going to be resolved, Anton, and the sooner the better.
Brian, everybody when this is discussed says a variant of what Kieran is saying, that at some point it has to be resolved. I'd throw my mind back to, I think, the late 80s, when they said the same thing about an air traffic controller strike in the United States, and then Ronald Reagan fired every single one of them. Are we getting to the point where if this goes on long enough, Aer Lingus might do something significant with that business?
Well, I think the really interesting stat out of that piece by Fergal O'Connor in the Sunday Independent was that Aer Lingus is only 7%, I think, revenue of the total IAG group. So these guys are small fry in the IAG group. It's a big story here. It's a big story in Ireland. But for IAG, they're like, whatever else they've done with pilots elsewhere, they've decided they're doubling down now, and they're not going to let what I think management in Madrid thinks is small fry in Dublin dictate to them what's going on. Does that mean, as kind of is outlined in that article by Fergal O'Connor, kind of a series of reforms that could happen over a period of time? It may well do. It may well be that they are just going to sit it out and, like, we're going to beat these guys. And I think the longer you come on and get entrenched, everyone says it's going to be sorted eventually. I mean, I mean, yes, that is true, but like, to whose advantage? You know, we are still none the wiser as to how it's actually going to play out, and neither side seem to be backing down.
Louise Byrne is with me. She's political correspondent of The Mirror, as is Brian Mattan, the correspondent in the Irish Daily Mail, and Kieran Mullooly, late of RTE, now of the European Parliament. By the way, we should say congratulations on your election.
Thank you very much.
Louise, the Business Post reporting that for the first time in a long time, Sinn Féin is not the largest party in the country by popularity. Fine Gael has reclaimed that title.
Yeah, it's a really interesting poll, actually, because it kind of really shows that Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin are neck and neck in popularity now, which is the first time in a long time you could be able to say that. It was by far and away Sinn Féin were miles ahead of everyone for a long time. But this poll in the Business Post today shows Fine Gael are on 21%. Now, that's down 1 point since last month. Sinn Féin are now on 20%. Another decent drop there for Sinn Féin that I say they'd be disappointed with. They're down 3 points. Fianna Fáil, we don't quite know where this has come from. Myself and the two lads were discussing this inside. Fianna Fáil up 4 points to 19%, which is quite dramatic in the space of a month. I don't think we've seen a boost like that for Fianna Fáil in a long time.
And do we know, is it a change of the manner in which they select the universe for the polling, or is it the same universe and they just are claiming that there's that big an increase in popularity?
Well, there was kind of, for the first time ever, we saw a distribution, if you like, of the support between the independents and independent Ireland. But that seems to really be the only kind of change in that. I'm sure Kieran will be delighted to hear that independent Ireland are on 5% popularity, while the independents are on 15%. The Green Party, I don't know if this is anything to do with Eamon Ryan hanging up his booth, but they're up 1 point. They're on 5% now. I'm sure it's not. Sock Dems remain on 5%. Labour down 1 on 3%. People Before Profit on 3%. And Ain't Too also on 3%. So really interesting poll, but I think those three, the main parties, if you like, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil, I think that's fascinating because, I mean, for an awful long time, we were all suggesting, or a lot of people were suggesting, that Sinn Féin had all but won the next general election and it was going to be them in power. But I think the closer you get to the election, whenever that's going to be, October, March, take your pick, that it looks like Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have kind of come back from the brink in a lot of ways, and that there is a possibility that this government that we have now, perhaps minus the Greens, could be re-elected. So I think Micheál Martin will be, well, I was going to say Micheál Martin would be delighted with this. We know Micheál Martin of opinion on opinion polls. He doesn't like them. He Micheál was
Martin
joyous
will say,
in the audience.
A poll finally reflects what he has been saying was their actual percentage for a long time.
I would
time.
Say Fianna Fáil pays plenty of money for their own internal polling as well. Come on, give me a break, Micheál.
Now, as to the Sinn Féin slip, Brian, what's your take on this? Because Sinn Féin, obviously, after the locals, were very clear in saying that they needed to improve the manner in which they were engaging with the electorate, sell their policies that bit harder and that bit more effectively. I take it they'll be disappointed to see that they're not getting payback if they are already starting that process.
Well, I think this kind of minus 3 points for Sinn Féin is a consolidation of the trend that we've seen over the last 6 months. And that's really what this is confirming yet again. I mean, the local elections were the most concrete kind of example of that. Sinn Féin hasn't really shifted anything, as far as I can observe, in terms of their policies or how they kind of comport themselves kind of in the Dáil or whatever. In the last couple of weeks, they're probably still in a period of kind of reflection, mourning and review, and trying to figure out what exactly went wrong.
So they're slightly caught in a number of areas, I would have thought. I mean, things like a lot of the analysis suggests that they were wrong-footed on issues like immigration. That hasn't become any less tricky for the party.
No, and they've doubled down and they've maintained the same stance that, you know, we're not a party in favour of open borders. They voted against the asylum and migration pact. And the problem is their support, the 36% that they got, that everyone keeps citing this poll from two and a bit years ago, that was always a mile wide and an inch deep, because it had the lefty liberals, urban, suburban voter going, Ona Brin's going to give me a gaff. And they had all the working class people on the other side who maybe have less kind of, you know, politically correct views on immigration. And then once immigration became the issue, it was the perfect or the worst wedge issue for Sinn Féin, because if they moved to the right on immigration, which they have done, they didn't move sufficiently right for those kind of voters. But any move at all to the right made all their lefty, liberal, lovey voters uncomfortable. So that it's the worst of both worlds for
although it has to be said, I mean, that old cliche about momentum being important in politics, they had huge momentum. There was a succession of polls of ever-increasing growth in popularity. It's hard to see how, albeit a very tricky issue, as you describe, was enough to reverse what seemed to be an unstoppable train.
Yeah, but I think of it going, when Anton, I think it all started to go wrong with the referendum. That's where all those polls started to turn. They backed the wrong horse. The referendum, the immigration policy fell apart. They were snookered on the border. They had a disastrous election, as we know. And to me, this big story today in that poll is the decline continues. You know, gone down another 3 points. Mary Lou says she's not going away. There's not going to be no change in the leadership. So what's going to happen in terms of the party? And could just say one other. Could just say one other issue? I also, obviously, would want to welcome Independent Ireland's showing in the poll, particularly the fact that the poll is showing that our candidates, our support is higher among women than men, which will also hit a few critics of Independent Ireland around the country. It's a great poll, 5%. Mind you, I would have preferred 8.3%, which was my showing in the election.
Do referendums matter, though? Because we've seen a long history of governments being able to win or lose referendums and then have completely the opposite result when they actually go to the electors.
I think the referendum result matters, and Sinn Féin's backing of the SES matters, because it shows that they were not in touch with their membership and their voters on the ground. So from talking to TDs and councillors and candidates in the local elections, there was plenty of them didn't want the party to go yes, yes. There was either yes, no or no, no. And that was advocated for by many in the membership and in the party. And yet the party made the wrong decision. And I think, much like Sinn Féin's position on immigration, in which they sound essentially like the government, a fair immigration system, adequately resourced, etc., etc., you know, it'd send you to sleep. It's like Simon Harris is saying that. What's different? They sounded exactly like the government on the referendum as well.
So, Kieran, do you think you and Independent Ireland have to some degree stolen some of their clothes?
I think a little bit of that. I mean, I think this is where I have to kind of take my hat as an MEP off from and look back at the political analysis of it. Yeah, I'm still stunned by the way the Sinn Féin vote on the ground has disappeared, and their help on the ground has disappeared. When I was canvassing in the election, you know, Michael Fitzmaurice was out with me every weekend. We were all around the Midlands and Northwest. There were no Sinn Féin canvassers on the ground. They weren't getting the people out. We're going into places like Sligo in the heart of their kind of say, we were there with a group of 10, 12 enthused Independent Ireland people. There were two people with the MEP.
But surely the Sinn Féin will point to the vast array of candidates that they had across the country and say, there is evidence of that depth on the ground. You can't run that many candidates if you don't have a good, strong grassroots.
But they ended up running too many was the issue there. And, I mean, you end up stealing the vote. And I think, to come back to what Brian was saying on the referendum, I think the other thing that kind of came is coming back to bite them with the referendum is the fact that they said in the run-up to it, yes, we'll rerun it if it doesn't pass. And then when they saw how overwhelmingly defeated it was, Mary Lou down in Dublin Castle that day, March 9th, after the referendum, said, no, we're not going to rerun it. So it was within a matter of hours, another U-turn. And I think this is the issue with Sinn Féin, that a lot of voters perhaps are starting to realise, perhaps not the right word, but I think the issue with Sinn Féin is that, and a former Sinn Féin TD said this to me recently, they're trying to be something to everyone, and that doesn't necessarily work. You need to stick to what you're good at. You have your core vote there. You need to be trying to win other people. Things like housing, Sinn Féin are very strong on housing. Things like health, Sinn Féin are brilliant on health. So you need to stick to what you're good at. You need to stick to what you know people are supporting you over, and trying to be too much to everyone. And Sinn Féin were saying at the last election, you know, we need change. We're the party of change. And I think perhaps more as we start to see what that change means, I think people perhaps didn't realise or didn't know what that change would be. I don't think Sinn Féin knew itself what they were promising change in 2020. And I think perhaps more and more as you see the policies that they're beginning to come out with, I think that's perhaps where they're losing people and why they're going to the likes of Kieran's party and Independent Ireland.
You're listening to the Anton Savage Show. That's Louise Byrne, who's political correspondent with the Mirror. I'm joined as well by Kieran Mullooly, MEP for Midlands North West, and Brian Mahan, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. Brian, you want to admit?
I just think to go back to that 36% figure that Sinn Féin had, it would be strange and unusual for an opposition party not to be light years ahead of a government in the polls when we were COVID, people were cranky. It's hard to believe that that was in the same dull term, the 2 year COVID period. Then you had the cost of living crisis, you had Ukraine. That's where Sinn Féin did have the wind at their backs. And it's, you know, I kind of recall, kind of, I think Ed Miliband, when he was leader of the Labour Party, he was 10 or 12 points ahead in the midterm, running up to the 2015 general election. And all the analysts at the time said, that's not enough. You need to be 20 points ahead because you're going to be reeled in. That was the kind of the traditional kind of analysis at the time. And so it proved. So, I mean, Sinn Féin being so spectacularly ahead was actually pretty normal and par for the course. And if they weren't, God, they'd really be rubbish at politics with a cost of living crisis.
Now,
that was handed them on a plate.
That this poll has is a finding that of those who have an opinion on the matter, there is a 2-to-1 support for the notion of going to the country in October rather than waiting through until March or April. If you were Simon Harris, would you look at a poll like this and say, right, we're going in autumn?
It's very hard to see the political logic of waiting until March in my mind, but the government seem fairly adamant in public, at least, that they're going to go all the way to March, but we shall see.
What do you think of that, Kieran? Because they sort of say that in some way there is an expectation from the public that they'll go full term. Does the public care if they go full term? What's the difference in a couple of months?
No, I think, you know, and you talk to their MEPs and you talk to their councillors around the country and all parties, this comes down to brass tacks. When do you want to fight the election? Do you want to fight it in the depth of winter after Christmas, or do you want to fight it in the warmth of a budget, which they hope they will produce before Christmas? So I think there's no doubt about this, that Simon Harris will call the election before Christmas.
I see a shaking head from Louise.
I don't think he's going to. I mean,
he keeps nailing his colours to the mast.
He keeps nailing his colours to the mast, and even you know, speaking to sources that would be close to Simon Harris, someone said to me during the week, I think you're going to actually be surprised when the election actually is in March, because you're all planning for it to be in October. But I mean, you can see the sense in some ways. You know, he's newly appointed Taoiseach 12 weeks ago, I think, on the last count that I heard him doing. He's going to want every minute in the Taoiseach's office that he can get. But I think the issue there, and I think it'd be rather...
As in, because this might be his only shot?
I mean, some might say, you never... But I mean, you never know. But I mean, at the same time, I think it'd be silly to go to March, because you just don't know what banana skins are going to come up. And if you call the election in October, November, and there's some kind of controversy going on, well, at least you can say, listen, we have the wiggle room we can go to March. If you're going right up to the last minute, what controversy could erupt in January or February next year? We saw it at the time of the last election with the whole RUC commemoration, all these kind of things. So you're losing, the closer you get to the cutoff, the lack of control that you have. And, you know, we've seen with this government time and time again that the controversies can just pop up out of nowhere.
Although the corollary argument is, if the trend line that Sinn Féin is on continues, and the trend line that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are on continues, and there is a decent budget, that's a little bit of a late show, one for everybody in the audience, well then you're advantaged by milking that for as long as possible.
I mean, you would assume, but not, you can't take anything for granted. And I mean, it comes back to, housing has been such a major issue over this course of the government. It was of the last election, it will be of this election as well. And I mean, it's when you see stories this week of affordable housing units in Dublin for €475,000, it goes to show that the government really haven't got a grip on this housing situation whatsoever. And that's what it's going to come back to. So while we're talking about Sinn Féin performing poorly in polls, the government aren't really doing anything to give itself much favour as well. I see Ciarán pointing to an article in the Sunday Times. I think that
just before we go to that, because a lot of the questions that we're discussing, only one person has the actual answer to. Fortuitously, that person is going to be with us in about half an hour. We'll be talking to the Taoiseach, Simon Harris, and we'll ask him whether or not he is still as committed to this notion of a spring election.
Yeah, just a piece on the front of the Sunday Times, Hugh O'Connell. And I mean, it's pretty, you know, the Fine Gael have ordered all its candidates to be selected by the end of September. It's very clear. He says concrete evidence. They're preparing for the poll. The deadline there is September the 22nd is the deadline. And I know other parties are doing it well. I know Independent Ireland, for instance, have been doing it as well. After the success of their local election, 23 councillors, one in three got elected. They're looking forward to continuing that with about another 7 TDs in the Dáil. I'm sure Michael Fitzmaurice would say he was if he was here. But they are going to be ready. All parties are profiling their candidates as we speak. And I genuinely expect this election, Anton, before Christmas.
Well, as I say, Simon Harris will be with us in about 25 minutes. There are a lot of coverage in the papers about RTE, the five-year plan, all the rest of it. We will get to that after the break. But just before, yesterday saw the funeral, Ciarán, of former colleagues of yours, Micheál Ó Muircheartaigh, and, of course, Tommy Gorman. A lot of pictures of people at both funerals. Huge turnout at both funerals.
Yeah, an extraordinary day in the life of the country. And some people said to me last night, what a terrible pity that both funerals took place in the one day. That was kind of a sentiment, a really genuine sentiment, that we needed to pay tribute in Lent to both person. But listen, the country did. What extraordinary scenes last night. I met Micheál Ó Muircheartaigh last during COVID. And, you know, that's only, 2 years ago. He was full of life, down at his house in Enfield on the Kildare and Mead border. He was out to show, Cormac's son is a physiotherapist, he was out to show the people how to exercise during cocooning. And he was full of life, like as if he was down talking about the sparrow, the cats and the fox, all these things in Hurley. What a contribution. He's made a beautiful piece this morning by John Bowman and RTE archive as well, which really hit it well. In contrast, Tommy Gorman's news and politics, people say it doesn't cross too many corridors. It did. Tommy crossed so many different areas and fields. And then I think back at Tommy Gorman, particularly Brussels, because of his contribution there and all of that Jacques Delors business, and Albert Reynolds coming back with the kind of being. He made his place in history, Tommy Gorman, but as a person, he will be remembered best for his human nature, his counselling, his advice. He was a bit like having a counsellor at the end of the corridor. I remember the first, within a week of arriving in RTE, he was on the blower to tell me what the difference between the council and the commission was in Europe, and I never forgot it, I can tell you that. But he also came back many, many times with telephone numbers and contact. He was a great colleague, and as I say, it really is such a sad week for everybody in RTE and for the nation. We've lost two tremendous broadcasters.
And one of the nice things in the coverage about Tommy Gorman is how many people talking about how kind he could be. I remember when my father died, Tommy Gorman, who I didn't know from a hole in the ground, sent me this lovely email talking about how when he had been in the College of Journalism in Rathmines in the late 70s, my dad had arrived in, who was lecturing at the time, to announce that he'd become a father. And he just did this gorgeous note about my dad, totally unbidden, no reason to do it, just other than out of kindness. And the amount of similar stories that people are telling of Tommy reaching out to do something decent.
The personal touch. I mean, Tommy met your mom, your sister, your brother, and did something nice for them as well. These stories always came back. They met Tommy Gorman in an airport and he came across and made a point about something you did. An absolutely outstanding human. I'm really, I was shocked to come out of a meeting in Brussels on Wednesday. Absolutely shocked. So many people caught by this sudden death, really, at the end of a tremendous career. And my thoughts are with his wife Kira and his daughter, and it's a maven Joe. And I don't know if any heard his eulogy yesterday. I mean, a chip off the old block. Joe gave an absolutely beautiful eulogy, hit all the notes that Tommy would have hit, every one of them. And I said, you know, we're going to remember Tommy for a long time every time Joe speaks.
53106, if you want to get in touch with the cost of 30 cent, or 0871 1106 on WhatsApp. Apparently, RTE is going to get its licence fee reinstated in the form of a licence fee that will be sufficient to pay and keep it running. That's according to a lot of the coverage and a lot of analysis about this idea of farming out the Late Late Show and farming out Fair City and what that will mean for staff. We'll discuss that after this break. And during the week, we had Kevin Backhurst, the Director General of RTE, releasing the five-year plan for the station, the big strategy. This strategy, of course, being necessary to unlock the funding from government to tide them over until whatever the new regime comes into place. He then held a town hall meeting in RTE, which, as I understand it, Brian, went down like a lead balloon.
Yeah, it was a tough town hall for Kevin Backhurst. I got a recording of it, which will tell you that the staff weren't delighted, and quite robust questioning. And I was in RT for another item earlier in the week, and the staff, like, you know, everyone from the makeup artists up to producers, anyone, they're raging.
About what?
I think there's a fear. One of them kind of said to me, like, we're not Channel 4. So there's a view that Backhurst wants to go to a Channel 4 model, which is to outsource the production of a lot of what RTE does to the independent sector, and then basically put it on RTE, and it's kind of has the RTE stamp on it. That's the way Channel 4, broadly speaking, operates.
And it becomes a commissioning vehicle rather than a production vehicle?
Certainly outside of kind of the core current affairs kind of space. And a lot of people are saying, like, we're part of the country. Like, RTE is like the state broadcaster. Like, you can't do that. I mean, Kevin Backhurst, A, can do whatever he wants, and B, has to do this stuff, because the government were kind of now accept from this report that the ball is back in their court in terms of making that longer term funding decision. So, I mean, I think Kevin Backhurst is going to have a savage battle on his hands with staff and unions, and Kieran might be able to speak to that a bit better. But a lot of this is probably going to have to happen if these reforms are going to go through and the government is going to be kept on side, more to the point.
And some of it, Kieran, seems like heresy. The Late Late being farmed out, Fair City being farmed out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the good China. And I mean, I know I've been speaking to people, former colleagues in RTE during the week. They were not happy with Kevin Backhurst's language the other day. I mean, it's simple as this. It's either been farmed out or it's not. And when was the last time BBC staff worked on the Graham Norton show? It doesn't work like that. So at the moment, there's about 150 people who work in studios in RTE. Then if we take the Fair City people on top of that, there's a lot of jobs which will effectively go outside. Unless RTE can satisfy staff somehow, they're going to get a contract renewal in there. But Kevin Backhurst has a job to do. We know he's in difficulty. But it's tragic for me that the workers in RTE are going to pay for the sins of last summer. This is clearly what's going on here. They're still trying to patch up the situation. And the other big story in the papers, of course, as we're reading particularly in the Irish Mail on Sunday today, that this great Catherine Martin plan to fund the RTE from the state funding is falling apart. John Lee in the Mail makes it very clear that Catherine Martin's plan has been effectively outmaneuvered by her friends in government. It looks like Pascal Donohoe and our new minister, Jack Chambers, are both in favour of the hybrid model, which is there again, the licence fee situation, which from an RTE point of view is disastrous still at the moment. It's still not recovering to the extent it should be. And state funding on the other side. So it hasn't been a good week for RTE, and I think finding that 400 number, which Kevin Backhurst says
is the redundancies
of redundancies, is going to be extremely difficult. And if I were on the staff, I'd be absolutely angry the way it unfolded this week.
Now, some of that presumably goes hand in hand, though. I mean, the suggestion that, let's say, you farm out the Late Late, that then becomes an independent production. Some of the staff who currently work on it may say, well, look, I'll take a package, I'll pocket the package, and I'll go do effectively the same job in the independent sector.
It may be true, but if you look at the profile of the age of the staff, it's not quite so simple in terms of people leaving an RTE. You know, the people who are younger may decide to get a package like that, but the vast majority of staff in there are not in that category. And the older you are in terms of your age, the less the package will be. That's just the nature of life. So, I mean, I think RTE have got to be very careful about this. And the backdrop to all of this is confirmation that we're going to have another announcement of a big payout to somebody over €400,000. This will drive both the staff and the government nuts in the coming weeks. The Minister for Heritage had told us we weren't going to have this anymore. It wasn't going to be announced, but looks like RTE cannot get around the confidentiality issue, and they're going to have to announce it. So no more than our friends in Aer Lingus and the captains and the pilots, it's a difficult PR job coming up for RTE as well. The big issue here is to get the confidence back of licensed bearers, and nothing happened this week that's going to help that situation.
Brian?
We've known for the last 6 or 7 months that there was going to be a couple hundred job losses in RTE. This week was when, you know, the rubber hit the road and he kind of set down, broadly speaking, how that was going to happen. So, I mean, people are absolutely entitled to be kind of upset that they're going to lose their jobs, right?
But voluntarily.
Voluntarily, but like...
For now.
Well, it can be done.
It's voluntary, but like, you're still being asked to not do the job you've done for the last 20 years. But, I mean, we all knew this was coming. You know, this is not really news. Per se, it's not a new piece of information. It's just like, oh, this is a reality now, you know.
I suppose maybe naively, some of the staff working in there thought that maybe the cuts would be in management, not on the Late Late Show's crew or on the crew working on Fair City.
Yeah.
Does it satisfy the ultimate need, though, which was to give the minister something that she could say, I have received a strategic plan, I am satisfied with it, I will now tick the box for funding, and life can return to something resembling normal, albeit with significant upheaval that will have to happen in terms of structure of the organisation?
That seems to be the case, and Simon Harris was saying yesterday that, you know, it's a good start, but that's all it is. It's a start. There's a hell of a lot more that needs to be done. And, I mean, RTE... It's not in a good place, and it's hard to see how we can get to a better place. And Brian and Kieran are right. When you talk to staff, the morale is down in the dumps, and it has been for the last year. And I mean, it's an awful long time for this controversy to be dragging on. And in a way, that's partially the government's fault, because yes, they were waiting for these reports. Yes, they wanted to see RTE saying what it was going to do. But this decision of what's going to happen with the future funding of RTE has been hanging over our heads now for a long time. And I think it's been very clear for a long time, as Kieran was saying, that, you know, Catherine Martin's idea of this direct exchequer funding, that Pascal Donoghue and formerly Michael McGrath, but now Jack Chambers doubling down on it as well, that it's not going to happen. I think it's been very clear for a long time that direct exchequer funding isn't going to happen. And I mean, this idea now that we're seeing across a number of papers this morning that it's going to be a form of the TV licence fee that will be more of a household charge collected by revenue, perhaps cheaper. Now, we say cheaper, €150 compared to €160. You can go buy a cup of coffee and a sandwich with your tenner. off you go with you. But I mean, perhaps if you have more people paying that household charge, if it's collected by revenue, you wouldn't have the levels of evasion that you would at the minute. But I think it would be a brave government to go any further than what they're going with this idea of a household charge or a broadcast levy or whatever kind of name that they're going to put on it when it does happen, because like we were saying earlier, we're so close to an election, whenever that is going to be.
Although it's funny, it's almost coming full circus back to Aer Lingus, because the one thing that everybody at this point is now saying about RTE is, whatever is the solution, can we just get to the point of finally getting it resolved and get on past it? One final thing before we wrap up, politics, but this time politics across the Atlantic. Brian, I assume you watched the Trump-Biden debate. The fallout from this...
I didn't, actually.
But did you not?
It's genuinely far too depressing, Anton. It's so depressing.
I think it's the New York Times' the headline today, yeah. The ghastly versus the ghostly, yeah. Which is just, I mean, if ever anything, summarised it. But very interesting to see the kind of reaction. A lot of still discussion about whether or not Biden can survive on the ticket, and all of the massed serried ranks of the Democrats saying that was a disaster. But
I mean, everything that I've read about kind of the debate and the politics around it since suggests that ultimately the Democrats don't feel that they're going to be able to force Biden off the ticket. You know, the New York Times can, you know, write their editorial lead and suggest it to Joe Biden, but ultimately it would be a decision for him and his wife. Look, Joe Biden is a frail old man, and Donald Trump is a crazy old man. And it's actually incredibly depressing. And you're like, you know, you chat to some people about Trump, and perhaps they're not as maybe alarmed about him as I am. But I mean, it sounds crazy thing to say, but like, democracy is at risk if Donald Trump wins, in my view. And the notion that all he has to do is sound marginally more competent than an aging man is like, he's such a low bar that Trump actually has to beat, because everything else with Trump is already factored in. You could pick any one of 15 things that are wrong with Donald Trump and that he's been convicted on or whatever. All the supporters, it's all already baked in.
I suppose if the Democrats wanted to cling to anything, Kieran, the last time we saw a discussion about forcing somebody off a presidential ticket to get another person onto it was Donald Trump after the Access Hollywood tape, when there was a discussion at the time that says he is totally unelectable, and then he went on and won it.
Yeah, and I mean, is it too late in the day? That's all I can think of it. I have a brother living in New York who watched the debate. I didn't watch it all. I couldn't watch it. After 20 minutes, for Biden's sake, I couldn't watch it. I just felt it so uncomfortable. But my brother was saying, like, the Gabby Cabby have decided it's over for Biden. The people on the streets feel that. The agency thing aside, you know, decision-making at crucial times, how is he going to be in a position to do that? So I think, you know, changing the candidate at this stage would be incredible. Would be a really, really a gamble, probably a losing gamble. But have they any other choice? I mean, and yesterday, the interesting thing about yesterday was listening to Trump already picking off the candidates. I see potential candidates coming forward and saying, "Well, he won't win. He can't win. He can't run his own state." So he's already started this process. So Trump has all the cards at the moment, and changing the candidate is not going to be easy.
I think I'm the only one that watched it. but it was very uncomfortable. And I mean, you were looking at Joe Biden, and I mean, I was in Washington Paddy's Day last year. Joe Biden was here a couple of months after that. And, you know, I remember being in the White House on Paddy's Day. Leo Varadkar was in one armchair. Joe Biden was in the other armchair. And it was both like the most overwhelming and underwhelming experience in my life, because Joe Biden was sitting in this chair and he was mumbling. You couldn't hear a word he was saying. He just came across so frail and in a way almost vulnerable. And in fairness, he picked it up as the day went on. And I think when he was here in Ireland last year, he seemed a bit better. He was, you know, he was shaking everyone's hand. He was making all these speeches. But I think it's remarkable to see the decline, if you like, in him in the space of a year. He just seems to become so much more frail, so much more unable to answer questions.
Although, interestingly, if you look at the early polling that's been done subsequently, it doesn't seem to have moved the needle greatly in any direction. All the analysis says it was a disaster, but everybody's still voting the way they were intending to vote before it.
Well, I think this is because you've two such divisive people. I mean, if you were already perhaps supporting Joe Biden, you're not going to look at Donald Trump and say, yeah, that's the man for me now. I mean, how many lies was he caught out telling on Thursday evening? And I think what was remarkable is that in some instances, because Joe Biden was so poor, you actually were looking at Donald Trump at some stages and going, God, he's actually coming across better here. He's saying the wildest, most off the wall stuff you could think of. But because Joe Biden was so poor, you were looking at him, Donald Trump, going, yeah, no, this man seems somewhat competent. And that's a very frightening thought. But I mean, it's scary that in a place, you know, the land of the free, such a vast country, such a vast, you know, array of people, that this is the best they can do. You know, two old men, one a convict now, would be sentenced to, I think it's next week or in the next couple of days. It's a very frightening situation, and I think it's going to be a very frightening 4 years for America, no matter what happens.
Well, I think just in terms of the implications for Ireland, you know, Trump seems pretty ambivalent about Ukraine. Maybe he can be kind of talked around on that. Who knows if he gets into power? But I mean, you could see a fresh influx of Ukrainians into kind of the EU if Trump kind of basically gives the thumbs up or whatever to Putin, or Putin kind of takes that as a signal to kind of push further on. And Trump also has not a huge amount of time for NATO. If Putin goes into a NATO country, what do we see happen? I mean, most of which are EU member states.
Doesn't bear consideration, yeah. Brian. Brian, thank you very much. Likewise, thank you to Louise and to Kieran. That is Brian Mahan, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Mirror, and Kieran Mullooly, MEP for Midlands North West.
The Anton Savage Show with Kieries.ie on News Talk.